The clerk will call the docket. You may proceed.
May it please the court. I'm Timothy Clancy from Waynesburg, and I was appointed to represent Oswaldo Martinez shortly before or at the time of his indictment in the Waynesburg James City County Circuit Court on multiple felony counts to include two counts of capital murder. It is the latter two counts that bring us before this court. In his current status, he has been determined to be, after multiple efforts that are spelled out in a great deal of detail in our brief, found to be unrestorably incompetent due to a fairly unique situation, language deficiencies. In other words, he does not meet the United States versus, or Dusky versus United States standard of being able to ensure that he has the capacity to understand the proceedings against him and, most importantly, assist his counsel, and it's due solely and unequivocally to his language difficulties.
Mr. Clancy, is the November 2, 2017 order, is that the most recent order?
No, that's exactly my next point. And I know you can do the math, Judge, this is a mandatory review every 6 months. I had a conversation with the Attorney General about this earlier. In May of 2014, there was an identical order entered, the same findings made under 119.2, 169.3F. And there's going to be another hearing in 3 weeks. It's anticipated, having spoken to the evaluators at Central State Hospital, the exact same order will be entered on that date and time.
So the May 2014 order, the November 2017 order, and the anticipated order coming up would all be the same order that we see here.
They would.
Well, then my next question is, these orders all state very directly that the purpose of the order is to, quote, treat the defendant in an effort to restore him to competency.
Yes, sir.
So the order itself presupposes that restoration is possible, although not yet achieved.
Actually, Your Honor, but I think the court has made the finding and the evaluators had made the finding as early as one evaluator in 2011, another evaluator in 2013, and the court in 2013, when they transitioned from being restoring him under 19.2, 169.2, but we transitioned 169.3F because he was not competent for the foreseeable future or not restorable at all. And that's why we had to go through the process. And the court knows this process. First, it had to be evaluated as whether he's a violent sex offender. Attorney General said no. Then see if he could be evaluated or committed to an intellectual disability. That was not appropriate. Committed for a psychiatric condition, that was not committed, that was not appropriate, and release was not on the table because it's capital murder, so we obviously pigeonholed directly into 19.2, 169.3F. So your suggestion that he is still getting restorative efforts, frankly, we point out in our brief that there's not much effort being done, 2 to 3 hours a month.
I'm with you on that, and you made a persuasive case about the pragmatic and factual aspects of it, but the orders themselves do say that.
They do, but they also track what the statute says. And that's my problem with the statute, and that's where it kind of dovetails into our argument about we're not contending any of the aspects of the statute other than whether or not this treatment, quote-unquote, is medically appropriate. And we point out that all evaluators, and in fact everybody that's worked with this gentleman, has determined he's plateaued. He cannot be restored because he just never at a formative age learned that any grammar whatsoever. So there's just nothing to build upon. So that treatment that he's getting, we would suggest, is not medically appropriate. And we're asking this court, in our brief, tell us what this means.
May I ask you this on the
yes,
statute? Your argument focuses on sub-Romanet, I guess, 3. But going back up a little bit in the statute, tells the court, look, if he's charged with capital murder, You don't dismiss the charge. And then the statute says the court may order that the defendant receive continued treatment under subsection A, etc. Provided that you have to do the hearing, and then you have to remain incompetent, and this part three, the continued treatment has to be medically appropriate. So the way I think a plausible reading of this is you may order continued treatment, but if you're going to do that, you need to make sure it's medically appropriate. In other words, if you, let's say you give someone a medication that has very harsh side effects, and it's just not working out, it's not having the intended effect. Well, that wouldn't be medically appropriate because it's all downside. There's no, right, so, or some, you know, novel therapy, and it's just not working out. So why isn't the reading of the statute, you may order the continued treatment, but if you're going to do that, that treatment has to be medically appropriate. And then beyond that, of course, the court has to find the defendant presents a danger to self or others, and that aspect I don't think is challenged.
It is not.
Right.
We didn't raise that. The medically appropriate, the only time that's ever been defined that we can find, is, and it's in our brief, and I think the Attorney General may agree, is the two United States Supreme Court cases, Evans and Self. And that talks about giving psychotropic medications or psychotic medications to patients. And the concern about whether it's medically appropriate has to do with what side effects occur.
Right.
Not the efficacy of that treatment, but the side effects of that treatment.
Right, but again, as I understand your argument, you're saying if you're not giving medical treatment, then you have to let them out. And I'm not sure the statute lends itself, but maybe I'm misunderstanding.
Well, I guess, yes, I am ultimately trying to get to that point. I'm trying to find a court that has jurisdiction to tell me whether that's possible or not. But I am suggesting it's entirely, at a certain point in time, I think it's entirely inappropriate and violative of due process and equal protection that somebody be held indefinitely.
But why is that? Because if you have someone who's charged with capital murder, and that takes, I mean, that's sort of the worst of the worst, because it's not only a premeditated murder, but then you have the predicates thrown in to charge somebody. Then the statute says, look, we're going to do these 6 months reviews. So you're getting oodles of due process every 6 months. Able lawyer comes in, represents you. And you have to find that he's a danger to self or others. So it's not like we just hold someone for no reason, throw them in a dungeon and forget about them. They're a danger to self or others. They've been charged with capital murder. And there's these 6 months reviews. Why isn't that plenty of process that is due?
Well, respectfully, because this gentleman has never had the opportunity to go to trial, and I hate to be flippant, but he's presumed innocent. He cannot go to trial because of his particular deficiency. So to answer your question fully, you're saying due process is satisfied because of the nature of the charge, despite the fact that he never went to trial, because we have a hearing where it's established he's a danger to himself or others.
But isn't that under civil commitment? If you can prove someone's a danger to self, you know, they're suicidal, and it's not just some, you know, casual thing, it's a pretty serious thing, or, you know, they're ill in some way and they might harm others, you can civilly commit somebody.
I agree. And if the court accepts the jurisdiction in this case as a civil appeal from the order of the Waynesburg-James City County Circuit Court and finds that the civil appeal is appropriate, and the court finds that that's a proper application of 19.2169.3F, then at least the issue is resolved vis-a-vis any future action we may take. That's kind of what brings us here.
Let's talk about that. I mean, this strikes me as just an interlocutory order in a criminal case.
Well, and there's not a whole lot of case law here, Judge. I guess I gave you what case law I could find. It's certainly not analogous to the Daily Press case. Which is cited in my opinion. I don't believe it's appropriate at all to be similar to the Green versus Commonwealth because the matter is an underlying criminal charge. I think perhaps I'm going to adapt my argument of your colleague and say this is analogous to a civil commitment proceeding, and because the procedures are the same as a civil commitment proceeding, despite the fact its basis lies in a criminal charge, then, and the standards of proof, it's my burden of proof to show by preponderance of the evidence he's incompetent, all of that, and all of those findings, I would respectfully suggest, perhaps relying on the Southall case, that despite it's an underlying criminal charge, because of the mechanism and the means by which he's being held, this would be properly a civil appeal. That would be the only way I could answer that question.
It's a very fair and very lawyerly answer. It just isn't right. It's obviously a criminal case. It's a capital murder, rape, murder case in a criminal action.
But what about a habeas petition? I mean, that's a vehicle. I mean, one, we have original jurisdiction, so you don't have this. Because one of your problems is you get these six-month increments, and, I mean, we can expedite things, and we have, but by the time you get your order, your petition filed, and all that, whereas habeas, we have original jurisdiction, you drop the petition, and that's often the vehicle to challenge illegal detention on the civil side, criminal side, pending charges, not pending charges. So I'm just not sure why that's not a way we can get at this versus trying to pound the square peg in the round hole of appellate jurisdiction.
I'm not adverse to proceeding that way. I thought I was bound, and I think I am bound, to the ruling of the trial court that said this must be appealed and pursuant to civil procedure, and I have to follow that. Now, depending upon how this court rules, we can look over the horizon and probably see what's going to happen. Perhaps if, Judge Kelsey, if we remand this back to the Court of Appeals, because it is a criminal case, and I go there, and they may well say that's not a final judgment or order, then perhaps I can do exactly what you are suggesting. But I think I have to go through these baby steps to get where I need to go to zealously represent Mr. Martinez's interests. He's being held.
No criticism implied. We're just trying to sort it out.
I understand. And it is such a unique situation. I mean, such a unique situation because, respectfully, I just don't think the General Assembly or anybody could have contemplated a situation like this. And I don't think the statute itself doesn't give us an appellate right. So that's what we're kind of searching for.
Understood.
Any other questions from the panel?
Counsel, if hypothetically, if a person was not going to improve medically because he or she was in a persistent vegetative state, where would that lead us under the statute?
And charged with capital murder?
Yes.
I think we would be squarely within 19.2, 169.3F.
And so you would be, under those circumstances, arguing for release?
I think I would if the treatment had no bearing and had no possibility of restoration to competency. I believe I would be making the exact same argument.
Okay. Second of all, you mentioned the equal protection and due process clauses and arguments thereunder. When I started to read the facts in your brief, I was a little surprised that there wasn't an assignment of error and argument on those constitutional questions.
We raised that.
As to why that didn't make it to us.
Excuse me for interrupting you. We raised that at the trial court, and that's within our appendix at one point, but the court, we withdrew it. The court ruled because we had an appellate right, albeit under the civil, on the civil prong of this court's jurisdiction, we felt we had to exhaust that remedy before we could raise those issues. But candidly, Judge, as I said, I think if I look over the horizon, you're probably going to see those issues if I'm reading the tea leaves correctly.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel.
Would you like to reserve some time?
Yes, please. I have a minute 58. Thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Jim. Please, the court. My name is Matthew Dolgan. I'm a senior assistant attorney general here this morning on behalf of the Commonwealth. I think the issue the court had directed parties to brief is dispositive of the matter this morning. That is whether this court has jurisdiction to consider the merits of the appeal as identified in the assignments of error by Martinez counsel. The only jurisdictional basis cited in his brief is the ability to bring a petition for appeal to this court from a final civil judgment. The order he's identified that he appeals is neither civil nor final, and there's no jurisdiction for that in this court. Indeed, despite the suggestion that it could be remanded to the Court of Appeals of Virginia, there's no jurisdiction there for a non-final criminal order, and the order he appealed from, as well as the May order, in like terms, on its face contemplates that there will be a further report from the treating facility if he should be restored in competency, or a further hearing if he is not restored to competency. It's on its face non-final.
Can you think of a reason why we couldn't construe the statute one way or the other if a habeas petition came to us?
I think a habeas petition, well, assuming appropriate allegations made in the habeas petition,
because that's ordinarily the vehicle
for the jurisdiction
for,
of this court to hear that issue, yeah. Certainly.
Yeah, I mean, if you're claiming this, I mean, going back to 1215, if you're illegally holding my body, then file a writ saying I'm illegally being detained. And in this instance, it would be because of an erroneous, according to the petitioner, erroneous construction of the statute by the state. And so I need to be released or whatever. I just couldn't think of one, and I don't want to, but I may not have anticipated every wrinkle.
No, I'm unaware as well, Your Honor, of any jurisdictional limit on a properly filed habeas petition to this court raising.
I mean, the only risk is that you're detained pursuant to an order that expires in 6 months, and if it's not resolved in 6 months, then you have to start all over, because that's then the order that is you're causing you to be detained. But aside from that practical concern, anyway.
And I suppose in that case one could make an argument whether it's a sort of thing that's capable of repetition but evading review.
Right.
But I do not see any jurisdictional impediment to bringing the issue to this court in a properly filed habeas petition.
All right. Well, so someone who is incompetent to stand trial, under this statute, do they have to receive any medical treatment?
The portion of the statute prescribing treatment does not specify that it has to be medical in nature. And in fact, as we pointed out in brief, when the matter first came back for the initial report from evaluation, the testimony of the expert, report of the expert, was that attempting to teach the sign language was the gold standard for attempting to restore him to competency where the impediment was his limited ability to communicate. That the treatment has to be broad enough to allow the court and the treating experts to address whatever it is that is preventing his ability to consult and communicate with his lawyers. And
do they have to be treated at all? In other words, if you're charged with capital and you're a danger to self or others, and you have to prove that, the court has to find that, do you have to even get treatment? Of any kind, medical or otherwise?
I apologize. I did not research that aspect of.
No, and it's just I'm just looking at the statute. It tells, and this is 19.2.169.3F. It just says if someone's charged with capital, we have that. Charge shall not be dismissed, and the court that has jurisdiction over the capital murder case may order that the defendant receive continued treatment for additional 6 months periods without limitation. So it says may order that he receive treatment. But you can't dismiss. I mean, that's the one thing the statute is crystal clear about. But what you have to do is you have to have a hearing, and you have to find him incompetent, and you have to find continued treatment to be medically appropriate. Well, but maybe there is no treatment that can be offered that would restore someone to competency.
I think that's a fair reading of the statute, Judge, that it gives the circuit court the ability to decide if continued treatment is proper under all the circumstances of the case. We of course, have a different view of what the medically appropriate limiting language means than has been advanced by Mr. Martinez's counsel.
Understood. Okay.
Let's talk about that. It appears that you have a view that the treatment simply has to have some immediate connection to the disability that's being addressed, and the disability here is a communication disability, whereas your colleague on the other side thinks it has to be something out of the Merck manual as opposed to the DSM manual. What would you say the context of this statute is, and what broader maxim of interpretation should we be relying upon when we go to these words?
I think the important, for the first question they raised, whether the initial treatment itself has to be medical in nature, we need to look a little higher in this code under 169.2A, where they talk about assigning the treatment, and it orders only that he receive treatment. It does not qualify as medical or psychiatric or any nature.
So any treatment, but if you get into the area of inappropriate medical treatment, you got to draw a line.
Yes, and I think that's the purpose of the clause of medically appropriate at the end, as it was in cells and cases we've cited, that if the treatment of whatever nature poses an unacceptable risk of side effects or other dangers to him or other problems, then it appears to be consciously borrowing the language from cell in those cases, that the purpose of making sure it's medically appropriate is that it's not doing unwanted harm or risk of unwanted harm in pursuing the treatment for restoration.
Well, makes sense, doesn't it? Because if the incompetency to stand trial is based upon a learning disability, for example, that would not actually have a medical diagnosis, but rather an environmental or conditioning diagnosis, then you certainly wouldn't say, well, I'm not going to restore him to competency because the only problem he has is a learning disability, and there's nothing in the Merck manual that talks about that.
Yeah, I think the only limitation in 169.2A is that it be treatment to restore his competency.
Understood.
But as I said, our position is that the section identified by the circuit court and briefed by Mr. Martinez simply does not give the court jurisdiction in the posture of this case brought to this court at this time to reach the questions of the construction of the case or, as alluded to in earlier questions, whether there are equal protection or due process arguments that may apply to the statute on space. And I'd suggest as well that the possibility raised by Mr. Martinez in brief that this court could simply remand the matter to the Court of Appeals would not be judicially economical or appropriate at this point. It's clear on the face of the orders, these are non-final orders, the Court of Appeals would not have jurisdiction either. I know this court in some cases has remanded to the Court of Appeals of Virginia simply because they did not have an opportunity in the first case to decide their own jurisdiction. But in this case, on the record presented, I'd submit there's no real question that they also would not have jurisdiction over the matter. And if the end of the road that Martinez counsel is looking at is a writ, once the matter is concluded in the Court of Appeals of Virginia, his question would move along better if there were no remand, if the appeal were simply dismissed.
May I ask you this last question? But the Court of Appeals, the question of the Court of Appeals jurisdiction, why wouldn't it be proper deference to the court to remand it to the court to address the issue as opposed to presuppose the answer from on high?
I submit it would be appropriate in this case to dismiss it outright rather than remand simply because there's no question from the record that this is an interlocutory order and no question from the Court of Appeals' own case law that it does not have jurisdiction over those sorts of cases. There really would be nothing for the Court of Appeals to decide other than clear application of statute and settled law. I may review my notes once. If there are no other questions, we would ask that the appeal be dismissed for the reasons stated in our brief.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebuttal.
Thank you. Please, the court. I would make the observation that 19.2, 169.2, the general statute that begins where we restore competency refers to treatment, and there is no precatory or any other limiting language on that. And we did that, as you recall from our statement of facts and chronology of the case, for 7 years before we transitioned in 2013 to 19.2, 169.3. And that's where that phrase medically appropriate comes in. And I guess I am respectfully asking this court to interpret that because I'm trying to figure out why the General Assembly put that in. Surely they didn't put that in just just to say, well, if you're going to give anything medical, it can't hurt him under Self and versus Evans. I can't imagine that would be the reason, but I...
But why? Why isn't it a nice, fail-safe to add textually?
Well, why not just say that such treatment can cause no harm?
Well, this is sort of a lawyerly way of saying the exact same thing.
Because if it says treatment is medically appropriate, then medically is it an adjective or is it an adverb to the treatment?
But how do you respond, because I can't understand what the response would be, if the actual incompetency is not technically medical, it's psychological, if you want to distinguish that, or it's a learning disability, why in the world would the statute say, look, if you can't find it in some, you know, if you can't find a chemical somewhere to deal with this, it's not medical?
I'm not sure I make it that limiting, but I understand your interpretation of that statute. And at first blush, that's the way I read that. And I say, well, that's why the General Assembly put it in here. And I put in my brief, the General Assembly never envisioned this particular situation where somebody could be incompetent for unequivocally non-medical reasons. In this case, an absolute language deficiency. And I would, in my last few seconds, I do think procedurally, if the court declines to accept this appeal, I do think it has to be remanded back to the Court of Appeals. Respectfully, if I'm going to take any further steps. And I think I've used up my time. Thank you.
Mr. Clancy, the court thanks you for accepting the appointment in this most unusual and difficult case. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Call the next case.